1027 Business with Michael Avery.
Well, we saw world markets consolidating a six-week high today, with investors digesting a possible slowdown in the pace of U.S. rate hikes. And we also saw U.S. markets open strongly, but then quickly reversing gains after data over there revealing that the U.S. economy unexpectedly contracted by 0.9% in the second quarter. And it's really all eyes on the Fed the day after. Lots to unpack with Liston Mainchies, independent analyst who's back from New Zealand for a while. Liston, great to have you back in the country. I hope you've been keeping well. Sadly, you came back into the teeth of load shedding, which I'm sure you had forgotten about over there in New Zealand. How are you?
Absolutely. The load shedding was rather a shock and a surprise, and I think we're quite lucky to be on the air tonight. So good evening to all the listeners, and as you say, let's talk about a very busy day.
A very busy day. Let's unpack the Fed firstly, and what really stood out for me was the fact that Jay Powell said he's now going from meeting to meeting, and he's not going to be backing himself into guidance. It just shows you how uncertain and volatile the situation is.
Well, not only volatility, but his credibility, because as little ago as November, he was saying inflation won't really be a problem, it won't go high, and it won't last long. And so far, he's got both wrong. So giving guidance like that is a big test of the credibility.
Yeah.
But, yeah, again, I guess the surprise for me, firstly, just on the GDP number, everything I read said it's going to be negative. Mm. I don't know why people couldn't read the same tea leaves and get the conclusion that it would be two consecutive negative quarters. Now we still have to get the people who announce these things to announce that we have been in recession or are in recession or are going into recession in the United States. In my book, yes, some of the employment numbers look good, but that's on a comparative basis. Mm. And it's true that, you know, some of the job numbers look now as though they're fairly normal, but I just say I don't think it's counting everybody who might be looking for a job. Shall we go back to unpacking the Fed?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe just for a broad audience out there, why is the Fed so important? Why do we always harp on what the U.S. Central Bank does?
Judging by the number of changes they make, you would think they were unimportant. And hearing a bit about quantitative easing now and again and whatever, you might still think, you know, do they actually do a job? But the key is it's very important everywhere else. And the first part is there are three parts to why it's important. The first one is that it sets a baseline for all other investments. So if you can get, and not that it's available now, but 4% from the Fed, safe as houses, and guaranteed, and short term. So if you're going to take something a bit longer dated, you need to be rewarded more. If you're going to take something more risky, you need to be rewarded more. Mm. So basically, it sets the baseline. And the higher you set that baseline, the more difficult it is to get the return that you require from the other items. The second thing, and this is quite important for us, is what other central banks do. Now, it turns out that they're all fairly synchronized. I say fairly, and then I'll come back to that. But particularly, you will have noticed from a South African perspective that the Fed raised 75 basis points last night. We raised 75 basis points last week. And I'm saying that was in anticipation of it being 75. I'll cover that in a moment. And then the third one is really the one that concerns everybody, is that it has an impact on every consumer.
Yeah.
And it can, in fact, impact more on those who are highly borrowed, but it impacts even those who have fairly low borrowings. The only people who really benefit are the savers, who for a change will get a return relatively high. Whether that's above inflation is another matter. Yeah. But let's just go move that down a little bit.
Yeah.
If we look at the baseline, you normally get a rising yield curve. And that's simply that if you're locking your money away for 10 years, you would expect a better return than if you lock it away for 5.
Yeah.
Now, you're not normally locked in, but basically somebody, whether it's you or somebody else, is locked in for that period. So you get a rising yield curve. The only time you don't get that is when it's obvious that the next move in from the Fed is going to be down, and you'll have a reinvestment problem. If you're investing at 10%, the cut rates, you'll only be able to invest at 8% maybe next time. So then you get what we call an inverted yield curve. But that's not the point. The point is that there should be a risk premium, and many people try and break it up into currency risk or country risk, company risk, industry risk. Yeah. You know, they try to put numbers on each of these things. But essentially, the market participants decide that certain items need to have a risk premium of X. And while things are going smoothly, they're not too concerned about it. When things are going badly, and you know, we have the saying that in bad times, bad things happen. And you'll find out that suddenly, and it's a Warren Buffett famous saying, where he says, it's only when the tide goes out that we see who's been swimming naked.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The problems only come up later. And I think everybody has now come to that conclusion. And you only have to look at Evergrande in China. It's an incredible property development company owing $300 million. I can't even imagine what that is.
It makes Eskom's balance sheet look quite healthy by comparison. Now, if you look at let's come back to central banks here, because really, and I think you made a very astute observation there as well around the Saab really trying to hike in lockstep with the Fed and what it's doing. And, you know, it'll say it's trying to fight inflation. I don't know how you fight inflation when there's no demand in the South African economy. It's different in the U.S. where they're trying to put a brake on consumption and cool demand. But what do you make of our central bank's response to hike in lockstep with the Fed?
Well, again, it's obligatory if you're trying to defend the currency.
Yeah.
Because people might be prepared to invest in us, and we talked about this risk premium at a premium of 7%. But the minute we don't move in lockstep, they'll take their money and put it somewhere else. Now, you see this very clearly in two other currencies. In the euro, where they have very, very hesitant to raise rates, and in Europe, a yield, and takes a yield in the United States. The euro is honestly, from about 120 down to parity. And you can look at the Bank of Japan, who have steadfastly said, not in our backyard, we're not going to raise rates. My goodness me, the yen has collapsed as well.
Yep.
So there's a very big impact on your currency if you don't move in lockstep. So honestly, this was much more a protective measure than trying to stamp out rampant demand.
I just wish they would be honest and say that. They talk about inflation expectations and second round effects. Just say, you know, we have to do this in order to protect the currency. Now, if you look at our market today, there was lots of action on SENS, and I want to move on to that because we are just pressed for time here. ABN Bev, second quarter results didn't look terrible. I mean, revenue growth of 11.3%. The market didn't seem to like this, though, and was one of the big losers on the day.
Well, again, it was certainly in the top 10 down. But you see, their total volumes didn't go ahead. And again, part of their problem, being an international company, whatever volumes they're selling outside of America are devalued in terms of their reporting, which is in a base pound of the US dollar.
Yeah.
So again, you know, they have a number of good items, like, you know, the plus 7.2 for the earnings before interest, tax and depreciation. But their margin contracted by 122 basis points. That just shows you the extent to which I don't think they're selling any cheaper in parts, but we've got additional costs, and I think transport is one of them. So their margin is reducing. Market participants do not like that. I think it's as simple as that.
And one of the big gainers was Hammerson, though, a UK-focused property company. Earnings up 154%, and this was one of the big gainers on the day.
Yeah, and in fact, that's the interesting feature. Both reported today. One was in the top 10, the other one was in the bottom 10.
Now, speaking of normality, it came through in Pepkor's results that the non-payment of that social relief of distress grant had a major bearing on their trading in May and June. And it's a very interesting debate that we're having in the country currently around how government can ever remove the social relief of distress grant. Now that it's there, it's almost baked in, and it's now feeding debates around whether or not we can afford some kind of basic income grant or universal basic income. But what stood out for you in the Pepkor result?
Oh, well, again, the part that interests me most, and we, you know, we always talk about growth stocks and value stocks and what have you, and it's normally based on some esoteric mathematical valuation. But to me, growth comes from the bottom up. And if you look at Pepkor Group as a whole, in the nine-month period, they only opened 227 new stores, making its retail footprint 5,772 stores. Now, to me, that's growth. It may not all have come in, and in fact, opening new stores is normally putting a bit of financial strain on a business, but there is a company, you know, which is growing.
Yeah,
and I guess that's right.
You can't go into a small town without bumping into or falling over a Pep in South Africa.
Absolutely, but you see, also they mention the social relief story, but they also mention flooding of a Sesopingo distribution centre. So a number of people, and it isn't only the retailers, but you know anybody who had anything going in terms of flooding in KwaZulu-Natal is going to produce the same. Set of complaints. And by the way, TFG, which used to be called Foschini, they also complain about the non-payment of the social relief of distress grant. But you know what, you mentioned, you know, can we afford it? I'm just going to put out there, and I'm not a politician, but I'm saying, can we afford not to?
Can we afford not to in the country? Yeah,
huge groups of people on the verge of hunger and poverty. And if the government, which I believe actually has a huge social responsibility, can't do that, then who can? And I just mentioned when I was in New Zealand, in our lockdowns, people who had to close had their salaries paid by the government. Yeah. They only borrowed, you know, 100 million New Zealand dollars, which is about $1 billion. But that's over, you know, an entire the population of 5 million.
So it shows you that there is an obligation here by a state to look after those who are poor and in poverty and really facing starvation. It's almost on every street corner around Johannesburg. It's on our doorsteps, and something has to be done around finding a way to provide some kind of basic universal support. Listen, Mainties, we're going to have to leave it there. That's all the time we've got for. Great catching up with you, our independent analyst who's back from New Zealand for a while, and he'll be on the show for the next few weeks while we've got him here. We're going to make the most of it because he's not going to be sleeping when we pretty much do the show because of the time difference. Listen, as always, a pleasure. Take care.
Hot 102.7 Business with Michael Avery.